The next matter on the calendar this morning is the case of State of Minnesota versus Archie Leon Price. Go ahead. Yes, yes, run. Thank you very much.
I'll run as fast as I can.
We'll wait for you. You don't have to run, actually.
They're probably sitting out there talking like people usually do, so. And they're perfect.
That's why I carry a big purse.
Yeah, less likely to forget.
Thank you. Council, when you reach the podium, feel free to adjust it to your desired height, and please tell us your name for the record.
All right. Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Council. My name is Lee Johnson, and I'm representing the appellant, Archie Price, who is appealing from several pretrial orders of the Hennepin County District Court. Front and center is the motion that he made to suppress evidence that discovered during the search of his barbershop in Minneapolis. And we're asking the court to reverse the district court and to vacate his conviction because, based on the totality of the circumstances, when those are all examined, the search warrant application in this case did not provide the issuing judge with a substantial basis to find probable cause. Now, the totality of the circumstances here, mainly, for lack of a better word, three events. There was an informant's tip, there was surveillance, and then there was a control buy. Looking at the informant's tip, the informant told police about a person named True, knew True's race, hairstyle, cell phone number, and said, and this is quoting, that the person known to him as True was involved in the distribution of controlled substances, including marijuana, from inside a barbershop located at 116 West Lake Street, Minneapolis, where True works as a barber. Now, the problem with this is it's vague. It doesn't really explain what involved with distribution of controlled substances, what he was doing. But the bigger problem is there's a lack of specificity. We don't know, did he observe this personally? How did he hear about this? And this court has never found probable cause based on an informant's information where the informant hasn't provided some kind of personal observation of either contraband or illegal activity in the premises. And that, in this case, is why police probably moved on to the next step. They set up surveillance. And during surveillance, they saw...
But sometimes it isn't it true that, well, especially when you're dealing with drug dealers, there is a lot of case law that says you're likely to find evidence of that back at the defendant's lair or his home. And that's routinely granted without any evidence specifically linking that.
You're correct there, I believe. Sometimes there's a little bit more information, like they want information like that this person's an established drug dealer. But here we're talking about the barbershop where he works. In fact, I haven't found one single case where a court, either federal or state, has made an inference that a person would keep contraband, drugs, money at their place of work, absent information showing that that's where they're operating from or conducting legal, storing contraband in or selling drugs out of there. And that's where we get to the next phase.
Which is precisely why, as you note, the police did a surveillance based on the tip, which would have been insufficient to establish probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor. And during surveillance, they saw two suspected drug deals with True, the employee. Both of these sales took place outside the barbershop. The first sale, he leaves the barbershop, but he accesses two storage areas of his car, the trunk and the passenger side. Then he walks over, meets this person in the alley. There's a hand-to-hand exchange. He comes back into the barbershop. The second control...
Did he go back to the car between the exchange and return to the barbershop?
No, not according to the affidavit. The second suspected sale... He's sitting in his car. There's no mention of him ever being in the
outside barbershop.
Presumably, it doesn't say in the affidavit, but I suppose you must presume that because there's conducting surveillance on the barbershop. But it's on a public street in Minneapolis, so it's not clear where it was parked. But the affidavit doesn't say that. I'm presuming, and I think you have to make some presumptions here, that it's close to the barbershop. So there's no indication that he's going in the barbershop. Before the sale, the guy walks up to the car, meets, hand-to-hand exchange, that's the end of it. No, he's not going back into the barbershop according to, and they surely would have mentioned that if he had.
So on the second one, he never,
Did he just drive away then, or we don't know?
Doesn't say.
But there was no observation or at least testimony that he went back into the barbershop.
The affidavit is silent on that. Now, again, police, what they do next is they set up a control buy with a second informant. And they tell this informant, meet True at 116 West Lake Street, which is the address of the barbershop. And when the affidavit picks up, True is sitting in his car. The informant goes to the car, gets in the car, and he sees other marijuana, baggies, and a scale, conducts the control buy, which we know it was a control buy. And at that point, True goes back into the barbershop. So we know that. Now, so what we have from the totality of the circumstances is, first, there is no illegal activity inside the barbershop. All the sales took place outside the barbershop. Two sales, he wasn't even before, and that's the second suspected and the controlled buy, was never in the barbershop before those sales. And the first suspected sale, he actually goes to his car and then conducts the sale. And he not only
turns to the barbershop.
Turns to the barbershop, but, yep. But before that, the key fact here is when you're talking about illegal activity is going to his car. Based on the other two sales, which took place entirely in his car, you must presume that that's where he keeps the drugs. And that's the second point, is that there's no evidence.
Presume from those facts that that's the only place he keeps the drugs and that's the only place he keeps the proceeds from the sales?
That's a good point. I would say no, because you could also infer, because he seems to be a drug dealer, that he would keep that at his home. You cannot infer, however, based on the Harris case and just ordinary kind of, just common dealing, that he wouldn't keep it at his place of work.
Are you talking about Harris, the circumstantial evidence case?
No, Harris, State v. Okay. Harris, and I think State v. Harris cites another case the State v. Harris sets out the four factors that you look at when you don't have direct evidence that contraband or drugs are on the premises and you're inferring that. So there's no basis to infer that he's going to keep the controlled substances, drugs, on the job. Who would do that? I mean, I think there's sort of a presumption that's not in the record because of the nature of the business. It's a barbershop in Minneapolis, but you have to treat it like any ordinary business, absent anything in the record saying it isn't, and there isn't. What the state did at the trial court level and the district court said, well, we're going to find that there's a nexus because he comes after the control buy and he comes back into the barbershop. He could have had those marked buy funds on him, okay? Now, the problem with that is twofold. First of all, we don't necessarily know that he did that because, you know, he kept marijuana in the car. Why not put the money in the car? But assuming that he did bring it into the barbershop, he's not going to stash it there. Number one, if you look at the Harris factors, that's just not what somebody's going to do. There's the opportunities for concealment, and where just a person would put it. Nobody, you know, an ordinary employee or a drug dealer is not going to stash money on the job.
You don't make the argument, but it seems to me that it's a close call on whether or not the warrant would have been justified to go in and look at his particular workstation within that business for the proceeds or anything of that sort. But obviously here they expanded that and went into the basement, which apparently was a whole different kind of business because it was like a recording studio or something.
Well, it wasn't so much a business as just, yeah, there was a recording studio set up there, but it wasn't, going off the record, it was Mr. Price's brother had his equipment in there. I mean, it's a big, huge area, and there's little storage areas, and they did have it set up, but it wasn't a, you know, separate business.
But it wasn't a barber shop down there.
It was a storage area. It's a basement. I mean, again, going off the record, almost dirt walls, and it's almost like a cave down there. But it was a storage area.
But you don't make the argument that the warrant was overly broad, because it seems like there could certainly be an argument that they were justified in seeking a search warrant to look at his workstation.
You know, I don't believe so, because first of all, we don't know how they operated in this barbershop. You know, because there's different types of barbershops where you have, you know, completely separate workstations, that's yours, and there's barbershops where when you show up, you use that chair and you cut your hair, where so we don't know if he had a particular workstation. I think if the facts had been developed that way, if the informant had said, yeah, True has a station and he has complete access to it, nobody's going to get it, the cleaning people won't get in it, it's a different story. But here the warrant doesn't lay that out. So I think I don't, in all respect, I don't know if I need to make that argument, because I think, that the warrant wouldn't allow that. I mean, there's no probable cause to go in there and see if it'd be in his workstation, because I don't know if he has one. I know he works there as a barber, but the warrant doesn't say that. And I think that would have been helpful if they, and that's the problem with this informant, this vague information the informant gives us, we don't know anything about what's going on in the barbershop.
And you could find no case law that addresses the issue of entering a business to search a locale for an
employee. I don't think I found one. I think there was a federal case talking about, I won't even mention it because I don't have the citation, but talking about, well, he wouldn't have kept, it was a child pornography case, probably wouldn't have kept it there. But it wasn't strong enough for me to cite, because I would have liked to have had some authority that's saying, yeah, you can infer that. But I think if you go back to so that puts us back to the Harris factors, which I think the state and the district court have paid little attention to, talking about where you can infer people will keep their contraband, drugs and that sort of thing. And I think when you run it through the Harris case, that works out in our favor, that you just can't infer that he's going to store proceeds. And I think the only thing, proceeds is the only thing that comes into play, because we know that he didn't store drugs. He was storing the drugs in his car. It's pretty certain he was. And there was no illegal activity inside the barbershop. So anyway, so I guess unless you have questions, I would conclude, we would ask the court, obviously, we would like the court to reverse the denial of the order of suppression. We'd ask the court to suppress the evidence, vacate the conviction, on the basis that, looking at the totality of the circumstances, everything that happened, the three events, there's not a substantial basis to find probable cause. It's not fairly probable that police are going to discover evidence of a crime. And the crime here is True's crime in the barbershop. Thank you, Your Honors.
Respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota. Good morning, counsel. Your honors, this court should affirm appellant's convictions because the warrant affidavit for appellant's barbershop was supported by cause. During my argument this morning, I'd like to again point out the importance of the standards of review here and emphasize the facts that demonstrate that the CRI, confidential reliable informants, tip was sufficiently reliable and there existed a sufficient nexus for the district court to find probable cause. Again, with regard to the standard of review, this court reviews whether the district court had a substantial basis for concluding that probable cause existed. And that, again, as appellant stated, is based on the totality of circumstances here. Was there a fair probability that contraband or evidence of the crime would be found in the particular place to be searched?
And what's indeed, the specific information, though, that gets us inside the barbershop?
Your Honor, yes, I can move on to that right away. First, with regard to the CRI's tip, a CRI's reliability, the district court may find that a CRI's tip and information is reliable in six different ways. And in this particular case, the district court found that the CRI's information was reliable because the CRI had provided reliable information in the past. And a second basis is they showed a basis of knowledge that was sufficiently corroborated by the police. So there's two different ways that the district court found in this case.
Doesn't this run up against the old Soto case?
I'm sorry, could you?
Doesn't this run up against the old Soto case, S-O-U-T-O, Which basically says that you can't make a general statement that something's going on in a location. You have to give some times, dates, what was actually observed by the CI to get you through the doors in a situation like this. I mean, I understand they corroborated that this fellow was selling dope and that he was selling it at least in the vicinity of his business, but the tip was that he sells it inside the business, and they didn't corroborate anything that helped that tip, nor do we have any specifics, as Soto would require, as to what information the CI had that made him or her aware that the sales were actually occurring in the business.
Your Honor, I have a few different responses to that. First, there is no case law that requires that a CRI be inside a particular entity to personally observe the criminal activity, which is then disclosed to the police. And in fact, Your Honors, there is a case cited in appellant's reply brief. It is State v. Cravegan, C-R-A-V-E-G-N, 356 Northwest Reporter, 2nd, 671, Minnesota, 1984. And in that case, the police wanted to conduct a controlled buy, and the location of the buy was an apartment in an apartment building. The police did not go inside the apartment building. Instead, they waited for the CRI to go do the controlled buy in some apartment in the apartment building, exit, and found the buy funds and field tested positive for narcotics. And in that case, the police could not see what was going on inside the apartment building. Indeed, they couldn't even find which apartment with their eyes from the outside that the particular CRI entered into to perform that buy. And nonetheless, the district court was affirmed in finding that, yes, there was a sufficient nexus between that particular appellant's apartment, which the police could not see, and the criminal activity, which was the controlled buy.
But the CRI could see it and could describe it to them. Here, you don't have the CRI describing what went on in the barbershop ever.
And, Your Honor, I can't say that the CRI didn't observe it. All I can say is that I agree that the affidavit in particular is less than desirable in its specificity
Doesn't that knock you out here?
It does not, Your Honor, and it doesn't knock
me
out.
Seems like it to me.
Your Honor, it does not knock me out. There is also no case law that says that the particular affidavit needs to explain how the CRI saw what they saw. Indeed, if it did, all confidential informants' identities would be revealed, and that is not appropriate. That is privileged information.
That's why you put in things like you talk to a CI who has been in this residence in the last 30 days and has observed people distributing marijuana. You don't have that. Just have a blank statement that he sells it inside the business, and then when they go to see what's going on, all the sales are occurring outside the business.
And, Your Honor, that brings me to my third point. Even if, as Judge Rodenberg surmised, even if a particular tip from an informant is insufficient, there's plenty of other corroboration and specificity of the tip here that makes this a reliable set of information on which to base probable cause. So,
reliable that he's selling marijuana, but not reliable that he's selling it inside the barbershop.
And, Your Honor, that gets to my nexus argument, and I can certainly move on if the court would prefer. With regard to the nexus argument, that ties specifically into the corroboration. There is specific importance to the location of all three buys that the police observed Mr. Green do outside appellant's barbershop. And that particular nexus is Mr. Green was seen either directly outside the back door that employees use to enter and exit all the time, outside the back door, performing the deals, and on at least one buy, exiting the barbershop, doing the deal, re-entering the barbershop. The second deal...
On that one, was there a stop at the car, though?
Yes, there was a stop at the car. But as Judge Rodenberg also mentioned, a stop at a car does not negate the inference that a defendant would have contraband in his residence. So it doesn't hold that a stop at a car between where the dealer's original location was and the deal, it doesn't hold water. You wouldn't have that inference. I hope I explained that appropriately. And in addition, at the second buy, I agree with appellant that the affidavit is silent on what Mr. Green did before and after that second observed buy, but that doesn't mean that the buy didn't happen directly outside the back door of Appellant's barbershop. And it doesn't negate the fact that all three of these buys occurred in that same location. There's clearly ongoing criminal activity of narcotics dealing right outside Appellant's barbershop back door.
But that gets to Judge Kirk's question. Right outside is not the same as right inside.
And Your Honor, the nexus there is you do have the CRI's tip that something is being distributed from within, and also the nexus between going in and out of the barbershop surrounding these particular deals and the close location of the actual deals to the inside of the barbershop.
He takes cash into the barbershop apparently on at least two occasions. Am I right on that? He takes he apparently takes cash in, assuming he's getting paid for whatever he's selling. Mm-hmm. He goes directly in and doesn't stop at a car or anywhere else before going inside.
Correct.
So from that, I can infer that there might be proceeds of drug sales in the barbershop.
Your Honor, of course you can conclude that, but that doesn't foreclose conclusions that this particular Mr. Green took only the amount of marijuana needed for his controlled buy and only took the proceeds from that buy back into the barbershop. It's not a zero-sum game when you're dealing in narcotics. That would be the common sense inference that you could make.
That leads then to my next question, which is why the warrant sat for 9 days before it was executed. If you were looking for controlled buy money, it seems like it might have been more than 9 days, actually, because I think the warrant, the application said within 72 hours this stuff had happened. So I think we might even have to add some more days to the nine. But if you're looking for controlled buy funds, it seems like you'd want to do that before 9 days.
And, Your Honor, as the affidavit shows, yes, the police were interested in finding the proceeds of the controlled buy, but that is just one piece of evidence that there was probable cause to look for. There's lots of objects, money, weapons, all sorts of things that are reasonably inferred regarding narcotics activity. Not including just the narcotics, you've got all the different pieces that go along with an ongoing distribution of narcotics from an entity. And so, Your Honor, I do agree that
not much going on in the barbershop except for the funds, which he seems to walk back in with. That was a really bad sentence. But that seems to be the strongest connection between the barbershop and the drug activities. He takes the funds back into the barbershop. The rest of it is all inference. You're using the word inference, and I agree with you. You have to infer from that he might have drugs in there, he might have guns in there, he might have all sorts of stuff in there. But the only thing we really know from this record that he would have in there is money. But then you wait 9 days.
And, Your Honor, I can't put my mind in the bodies of these police officers in determining when to execute and when not. I do know that this was a complex case since there were multiple co-defendants. And I do know that although the strongest connection would be the buy funds, that does not negate that there is also reasonable inferences that other contraband would have entered the barbershop with Mr. Green, either on his person or going to work that day. There's many connections between this particular barber, Mr. Green, and Appellant's barbershop that support probable cause here. And in addition, so at the very least, these are not easily knowable facts that the CRI provided. There's case law to indicate that a particular street name is specifically detailed enough to support a district court's conclusion of indicia of reliability of a CRI's information to support probable cause. So you had the particular street nickname, the address where Mr. Green was then observed repeatedly selling drugs right outside the back door of the barbershop, the type of the drugs sold, Mr. Green's occupation as an employee of the barbershop, as a barber, Mr. Green's physical description, the phone number, a positive ID of Mr. Green. There was additional corroboration, so even if this court determines that some other indicia of reliability of the CRI's information isn't sufficient, there is at least corroboration here. And finally, Your Honors, with regard to the nexus question, I believe it was Judge Kirk who asked whether or not there was any case law supporting a nexus between an employee's place of employment and criminal activity, and please correct me if I'm wrong. I would just direct the court's attention to State v. Metsala, and that case is an unpublished case from the Minnesota Court of Appeals that I have cited in my brief. It's a car dealership case, and in that case, there was a particular defendant who stole a bunch of tools, and the tool case, excuse me, I don't have the vocabulary, gigantic toolboxes, gigantic tools worth $100,000. So that particular defendant hung out frequently at his friend's car dealership, and his friend's name was Metsala, the defendant in that case. And that relationship was just hanging out frequently at that car dealership. And in that case, the defendant, Metsala, did not challenge the nexus between the person who stole the tools and his dealership. Instead, they challenged it on other grounds, but there was no reason to challenge that. And clearly, an employee-employer relationship is a lot closer than just hanging out at a particular place in connection with contraband.
But what was the information that got him into the place in that case?
There was the victim thought that perhaps since that particular defendant went into the hung out at Metsala's car dealership that he might see his tools there. That particular private citizen did snoop around, looked in a particular office and saw tools, called it in. So again, that's a tip.
So you have specific information, it's there.
Well, that is true, and also that is a first-time citizen known informant, which is presumed reliable. Right. But, Your Honor, that gets to the nexus question. In that case, that nexus was never even challenged. That was not addressed, but it also wasn't found insufficient. And what I'm saying is the bar is low for that particular case, and this case clearly surpasses that bar, if there is a bar. And then finally, Your Honor, Your Honors, I will just note that this inquiry for this court is whether the district court had a sufficient basis to conclude that there was a fair probability that contraband of the evidence, contraband or evidence of the crime, would be found in a particular place. And again, that's appellant's barbershop. Police observed multiple drug deals right outside the barbershop. And they also observed Mr. Green's entry and re-entry into the barbershop on more than one occasion after the deals. So that, coupled with the CRI's very specific information about the street nickname, the location, the phone number, the description of Mr. Green, all of that corroborated information, and based on this particular police officer's training and experience, meets this threshold, and that the district court used the appropriate totality of the circumstances approach, not nitpicking each particular
part. Your time is up.
Thank you. And then this court should affirm.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In rebuttal, Your Honor, the state's making emphasizing the fact that these sales took place near the barbershop, and that's a big part of its case. But what I think, and I haven't really argued this, but it's an important point, is that all of these sales took place outside the barbershop, and that's significant because of the nature of the barbershop. If this was his home, then you would say, well, okay, he's not going to soil his where he lives. He's going to try. He's hiding. You know, it's what drug dealers do. They try to stay away from the home. But there's an inference. But when it's your workplace, the inference you must make is that he left his home because he can't sell drugs out of the workplace because they won't allow it. He can't store drugs.
But why do we need to make that inference? I mean, employees are fired from their jobs frequently because they do things at work that their employers don't know about. Why do we need to make an inference, as you suggested in your main argument, that because this is a workplace, he wouldn't keep the contraband there, and he wouldn't, that there is no nexus?
Well, the inference, the reason I'm framing it like that is because there's no direct evidence that he stored or brought drugs into the workplace. So in order to find probable cause, you have to, you know, you can infer it. Yeah, and
yes,
I'm saying that you can't make that inference.
And I don't understand that argument, why we need to start out with a presumption, as you're suggesting, that there can be no inference.
Oh, okay. And I don't mean to do that. What I've done is I've ran this through in my brief, I run it through all of the Harris factors. And, you know, you look at the nature of the item involved, narcotics, money, contraband. Those are items that, you know, they're illegal. You don't keep those in public places with regard to, and then there's also where people would ordinarily keep items like that. And they wouldn't keep it in the workplace because, you know, you have janitors coming in, you know, you have other employees, you have members of the public, police officers can come in there and get their hair cut. It's not ordinarily where you would keep that. And when you apply those inferences to the home, then it's more plausible. Yeah, that makes sense. But, you know, there's just not the security for these items at a workplace. At your average workplace. That's
all
kind
right.
of what that's so I'm not making a presumption. I'm just, you know, kind of jumping ahead. One factual, this is just a minor situation. There were not other co-defendants in this case. Mr. Price is the only one I'm aware of who was charged in this case. It is a bit, just like any case. And I think some of the situation is it was a little streamlined process where we didn't have a hearing and it's kind of a short affidavit. Regard to
the guy who made the sale was never charged?
Not as far as I've seen. I have limited information. It wasn't made aware to me, and I've looked on MNCES. And
so yeah, you don't know if he was charged or not?
I haven't seen anything, so I would say yes, I don't know. I have made some inquiries, but I haven't been able to confirm that. With regard to the State v. Metzala case, that, as the court pointed out, they had direct evidence there was contraband in the premises, so they didn't need to do what we're doing here in our case. So I would argue that doesn't apply.
Well, it seems like I just took a quick look at it. That looks like that was had more to do with the search of a particular area within a building. And
I think so, but I know what prompted the search warrant is that somebody actually went in there and looked through the mail slot or whatever and saw tools in there. So it was okay. The tools are there. Or where in our case we don't have any evidence like that.
Except for the money.
Well, you know, that's a good point. The money, I think when you look at the Harris factors, the nature of money is that it's very portable. So it isn't only whether he brought it in there. The question would be whether he'd stash it there. And that, I think, was
where... And it's also a question as to whether it would still be there 9 days later.
Exactly, yeah.
He might be better at holding on to money than I am.
Well, and even the search warrant suggests it was 30 days. Not nine. I mean, that's 30-day period, not that it happened the day before the nine started to run.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but it's at least 9 days before they come in and search. And they don't see him carrying a briefcase in from the control buy. I'm assuming it's a pretty small amount of money. And with regard, and just one other point, Your Honor, with regard to the second suspected sale, there wouldn't be any way of identifying those proceeds, you know, obviously because it's a suspected sale and we don't know if there was money, and it's certainly not marked money.
Well, then with the CRI, the second CRI was marked money,
right? Yeah, the control buy was marked money, but there was another sale.
First one.
Yeah, where he went back into the barbershop, assuming he had money with him. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued, and it is taken under advisement.